This is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show. Support for this free service comes from the members of WNYC. During our current fundraising drive, please become a financially involved WNYC member. For a $50 gift, you'll receive a WNYC iPod cover. You can see the iPod cover and all the ways we'd love to say thank you and make an e-pledge at WNYC.org.
Frank McCourt says he became an authority on misery of all kinds after Angela's ashes. Considering some of the horror stories we've heard about New York City's public schools, you might imagine that misery would be at the heart of his latest book, Teacher Man, about his 30 years as an English teacher. But Mr. McCourt has mostly fond memories of those years and many happy stories to tell. His book is due out from Scrivener next month, and I'm very pleased it has brought Frank McCourt back to my show today. Hello.
Thank you, Lenny.
How long ago did you retire from teaching?
1987.
So you've had a lot of time to think about
it. Oh, I've had a lot of time to think and wander around and wonder what the hell I was going to do next with the years left to me. You start thinking about finer things. It was very strange retiring from teaching after all those years. And then the summer of 87. And then September comes. The day after Labor Day was when the teachers were supposed to be back. To wake up that morning and say, oh, Lord, I don't have, no bells will be ringing today. And no, Mr. McCourt, no noise. The noises were in my head.
But did that feel liberating, or were you already a bit nostalgic for it?
I was always a bit nostalgic. I began to feel useless. And I would wander. I was living on 14th Street near 6th Avenue. And sometimes I would just wander over towards Stuyvesant High School, which is on 15th Street and 1st Avenue.
Before they moved it downtown.
Yeah, before they moved it. And then I felt teachers had a purpose in life. And who was I? What was I now? Just a retired teacher.
But you'd also describe teaching as the downstairs maid of professions.
Yeah.
So even though they have a purpose in life, you are suggesting that they're undervalued.
Well, that's the image of the teacher, isn't it? In America, not like Europe, where you're called professor and you get respect. Everybody respects you, but maybe in some of the tougher high schools in the so-called urban centers. I visited some in London this year, and they have the same problems. But I began to change over the years. If you don't change, you're dead. I began to change my view of the way the world views teachers, and then I found the world at fault because of the way they view teachers. You wouldn't want your—I say this to people, not you, Lenny—but you wouldn't want your son or daughter to go out to college for 4 years and then come back and announce that they want to be teachers. What are you talking about? We sent you to school, Hull College, for 4 years, and now you want to be a damn teacher? No.
It used to be the profession of women who couldn't get jobs anywhere else. Several times in your book, you mentioned punching a time clock. New York City teachers still punch time clocks?
No, I don't think so. I think that's been stopped.
Because that really, people who think of themselves as professionals hate the idea.
That was another thing they used to stick in our craw. And sometimes assistant principals and supervisors would stand there to make sure it was you, not because sometimes teachers would get other. For instance, if you didn't have a class the last period, you'd leave a little early, and somebody else would punch you out. Oh, if you were caught, there was that dreaded thing called a letter in your file, and that was like putting in a hand grenade in the file cabinet.
But that was the same sort of threat that teachers gave to students. I remember this will go on your permanent record.
Yeah. Oh, it filters down. All the craziness filters down right from the chancellor to the very lowest student.
But you said that people envy teachers as well because of ATO. Or is it ATTO?
All that time off.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous because teachers don't have any time off. Maybe when you get older and you can put a few dollars in the bank, you can take the summer off. But most teachers have to have summer jobs. Most teachers have jobs teaching. Who do you think is teaching in all those evening high schools and elementary schools? Teachers who can't make it on their daily salary. So you don't. In addition to that, if you have two or three kids, then you have to have two jobs, and then you take all that work home. I challenge anybody who's listening to do a little bit of arithmetic. Say you have 170 kids in five classes every day, and you tell those kids to write at least 250 words. How long do you think it's going to take 170, 300, 250 word essays?
Even Evelyn Woods would have a hard time getting to them.
Oh, absolutely. We never, and you never hear speed reading anymore. That was John F. Kennedy started that craze.
What did you think of teachers when you were growing up under those terrible circumstances in Ireland?
Oh, we dreaded the teachers in Ireland.
You had no teachers who inspired you?
No. There was one teacher at the end, Mr. O'Hallan, who was the headmaster of my school, who told me I had some writing talent. And he had this grand manner, and he said one day, "My boy, you are a literary genius." Well, you can imagine what I had to put up with in the school, in the schoolyard. Oh, here he is, the literary genius. How are you, Frankie?
So if someone had told you you'd become a teacher someday, in fact, make a profession out of it.
No,
you
first
probably
of all,
thought they were crazy.
You have no idea of how low my expectations were for myself in life. I thought I would be happy to come to New York and get some kind of an office job. And there was one word, that one adjective, it had to be dry. That because I was always wet, and I was a telegram boy delivering telegrams all the time, or working for this news agent and delivering magazines, etc., etc. And it seemed we were always wet. Now, maybe that was an exaggeration, but that's my impression of my life. So I thought when I came to America, I'd like to have a bone dry job in an office.
My guest is Frank McCourt, and his latest book is Teacher Man, a memoir. It's published by Scribner. But you went to college here. And then you didn't start teaching once you got out of college. Why?
No, not right away. I couldn't get. It was hard for me to get a job because of my accent. You had to take a speech test at the Board of Education over there on Livingston Street, and I was told I'd had to take remedial speech, and I should come back. But in the meantime, I could get a temporary substitute license, so I was allowed to teach, which I didn't do right away because I felt awkward over this requirement.
Did you find some dry jobs to fill the time with?
I was working down in the warehouses down on Leroy Late Street, down over way over on the west side, and I do shape up jobs on the piers.
Did that pay better than teaching?
Oh, that paid much better, but it was tough. It was hard, and I said, what the hell did I get a college education for? And some of the people would say that to me. What are you doing here? You could be off teaching or something like that. Would your college degree? And they would. And I felt so timid that I thought I couldn't teach. I couldn't see myself going into the classroom. But finally, I did it.
In Staten Island at McKee Vocational and Technical High School. You weren't living in Staten Island.
No, there was a newspaper called the World Telegram and Sun. And they used to have a school page. And there were teacher vacancies. And it was hard to get teaching jobs in a regular high school. So I saw this one, McKee Vocational Technical High School, St. Mark's Place and Wall Street. So I went down to Wall Street looking for St. Mark's Place and McKee Vocational. And I asked two cops, and they shooed me away. There's no schools in Wall Street. I said, there are. I showed it to them, the World Telegram. They no, get out here. They were very impolite. So I called the school, McKee, and I said, where are you? Staten Island. Mm-hmm. So it was a short walk to the Staten Island Ferry.
And then it was close to the ferry?
It was about a five-minute walk up the hill at the place called St. George.
And you were teaching English. How interested were the students at McKee in studying English?
The students at McKee were all were in plumbing and auto mechanics and sheet metal, et cetera, beauty culture. And they no more wanted to be in an English class than I would like to be in a calculus class.
I remember taking some ed courses when I was in college and thinking that I might teach. And then when I observed, it seemed to me that I'd never be able to maintain order, that the kids immediately spotted a new teacher and spotted weakness, then they took advantage. Was that a problem for you?
Yes, it was a problem because what saved me was my accent. You teach, you Scotch or something. And then, no, I'm Irish. And I've written in the book about what I knew what they were up to. That they they were curious on one hand as to who I was and where I came from, and on the other hand, they were trying to keep me away from whatever lesson I might have been planning. And also, the girls liked me; they thought I was cute.
Meanwhile, you were also an immigrant, and many of them came from immigrant families.
Yeah. There were a lot of in Staten Island, a lot of Italian families. That it was a fascinating. It was my real introduction to Italian culture. They even had backyard vineyards. They had farms over in Staten Island. This is before the Verrazano Bridge was built. So you had a lot of kids coming over on the 69th Street ferry from Bay Ridge. And I know a lot of people are going to ask questions about that when they read this. How could you have kids from Brooklyn? Well, we did. Dozens and dozens, mostly Italian kids.
That's before busing. This was ferrying.
Yeah, ferrying.
When did you realize that you could teach these kids and that they actually would pay attention to you?
Well, I was never, what would you call it, an intellectually conscious teacher. Things would happen. For instance, I'll just refer to something that happened at McKee Vocational High School. The kids were taking a test one day, and I started looking at this, pulled out a drawer filled with these excuse notes that the kids had handed in, most of which they'd written themselves. And I started reading them, and I realized this is a treasure trove. These kids who whine and moan about having to write something, when it came to writing excuse notes, they were brilliant. And then I zeroed in on that, and I started having them write excuse notes for various historical figures.
Oh, that's very clever. And they were intrigued.
Yeah, I had them write an excuse note from Adam and Eve to God, explaining their actions.
You say that you allowed your students to sleep on the floor during one of your classes.
No. This was a fantasy I had. I thought if I were completely free, this at McKee, if I would just have them lie on the floor. At that time, I wouldn't dare do it in those days. But later on, at Stuyvesant, I did just that.
Because the kids needed more rest?
No, because it would get them out of their seats, rearrange things, give them a different kind of feeling about the classroom.
On the other hand, weren't you reprimanded for encouraging a girl from one of your classes at McKee to go to college?
Yeah, I was.
But did they think that you were just encouraging her to aspire higher than she should?
Some people so set in their ways thought that if you went to a vocational high school, and you know, the vocational high school at that time was the lowest in the scale of any school. And some teachers and so-called guidance counselors thought you shouldn't encourage them to rise above their station, as they used to say in the old Victorian manners book. No, stay where you are. Be content with your lot. So I was told I shouldn't encourage it, but I saw talent.
You know, and also your own story belied that.
Yeah, and I didn't even think of that. I didn't have enough, what would you say, pride or self-esteem to be able to say, look, I did it. And I didn't even go to high school. So they got to high school, and here they are sitting in my English class with brilliant tutoring.
How long did you stay at McKee?
8 years.
And then you decided you would teach at a community college.
Yeah, I got a job.
Was that because you thought that it would be easy to teach people a little older?
Yeah, it was and fewer classes, less time in the classroom. By then I had earned my MA at Brooklyn College.
Let's take a little break, and we'll come back to that, and then we'll talk about Stuyvesant and whatever else we can get in here. My guest is Frank McCourt, whose latest book is called Teacher Man, a Memoir, and it will be released by Scribner next month, but we thought that we would catch up with Frank McCourt now. Stay with us. With Frank McCourt. Most people know his story by now, born in Brooklyn to Irish immigrant parents and then returned back to Ireland, which was the subject of his first book, Angela's Ashes. won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award, also the L.A. Times Book Award. Then came Tiz, and now he has told the story of his years as a teacher in New York schools. It's called Teacher Man, and it is published by Putnam. So
Scribner.
Oh, well.
That's all. Okay.
All these publishers are the same. all the schools are the same. So you went to New York Community College in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Were you living in Brooklyn at the time?
Yeah. It is now known as New York College of Technology. It's a four-year college now.
And what were you again, teaching English?
Yeah.
Did it pay better?
No, but I had. I wanted to. I think I wanted to break away from the schools. I thought I'd write. That would give me more time. And I tried it, you know. But then I didn't have a PhD, so the head of the English department told me, sorry, there were people. Places bristling with PhDs trying to get that job.
On the other hand, I'd imagine it was easier teaching there because at community colleges, the students tend to be a little older, a little more mature,
yeah,
in their 20s.
Yeah. I had one class, which I wrote about in Tiz, of 39 women, black and Hispanic women, ranging from 19 to 65 or something like that. All working women, all mothers of families. I mean, I think I taught the number of children. There was 300 and something children from these 39 women. And that it was very inspiring because I walk into that classroom and I'm the whitest thing in the room. And they had never been, there was some program under Johnson's administration that allowed them to go to college. I forget what it was. But here, they were very tentative. They never, like me, they never expected to be in college. I certainly never expected to be teaching them.
And you say that they had never been taught to think for themselves. They found it difficult when you asked them for their opinions. I don't mean those women in particular. Yeah. Most of the students you dealt with.
Well, they had opinions. You know that were on the train or when they went home, they talked to their husbands or wives, that they had opinions, but they were very tentative about expressing them in the class.
You also had some funny stories to tell. One involves a man named Tomas Fernandez, yeah, and then there's also Freddie Bell.
Yeah. Tomas, he didn't realize that you have to be in class in order that you have to come to this English class on Mondays and Wednesdays. And he started absenting himself on Monday nights because of Monday night football, or sometimes the Giants would play over in the Meadowlands on Monday night, and you couldn't, you're not going to desert your Giants for this. And I said, come on now, Tomas. And he couldn't understand. And he said one time, I'm trying to understand you, Mr. McCord. I'm trying to help you. As if I had a dilemma.
Freddie Bell wrote in a very florid style.
Yeah.
Wasn't that something you would appreciate?
No. I was looking for simplicity and clarity. An evil genius somewhere who was a former English teacher telling Freddie, you know, use the English language. It's a great organ. And he would get into it. He'd dip into the Roger's thesaurus and use all these flowery words that meant bugger all.
But there's another reason students often overwrite. It's because if they have to write a 200-word essay and they have about 50 words
to go, they're going to fill it up.
Pad it.
Yeah.
So you left because you didn't have a PhD, and then you went back to another vocational school, the Fashion Industries High School.
Yeah.
Does that school still exist?
Yeah, it's up there on West 24th Street.
Uh-huh.
People confuse it with Fashion Institute. But it's a high school.
And you say you were hired even though the head of the academic department took an immediate dislike to you.
Yeah. And I to him. If he didn't like me, I wasn't going to like him. It was obvious. And he took me only because the principal had instructed him to take me. Because the principal was a friend of a man at McKee Vocational High School who recommended me. And I think there were members of the Knights of Pythias or something like that. So that's how I got into fashion industries, but I didn't last.
He didn't like you because of your accent? Or is it just things, so he didn't like the way you parted your teeth?
He didn't like my lack of ambition.
Ah.
Because he had all his teachers preparing to rise in the system to become supervisors and assistant principals and so on. I said, I didn't have the nerve to be scornful or anything. I said, I just want to teach. And I think that irritated him.
Well, there's the Peter principle. There are so many good teachers who wind up becoming assistant principals and being lousy administrators.
Yeah.
But your contract wasn't renewed because you struck a student in the face with a rolled-up magazine. That is a no-no.
I know that's a no-no. There's a lot of things going on.
It's amazing you got another job.
Yeah. Well, I slapped this kid across the face with a rolled-up copy of a magazine. And that was partly responsible for my departure from the fashion industry.
What did he do to get you to lose control?
Well, I told the story. I was in a bad mood over something that was happening in my marriage. And I just, he did nothing really that kids don't normally do. It's, you know, adolescents, like everybody, get into a bad mood. I told him, open your magazine to page 9. He didn't do it. He just defied me. He just wouldn't do it. And I just slapped him across the face. And he walked out and he uttered an expletive.
So how did you get another job after that? You went to Seward Park High School.
Well, my wife was working in Seward Park and she was going on a maternity leave and I stepped into her place. Then the head of the English department at Fashion Industries was made principal of Seward Park. So he came to Seward Park, and I didn't last long there.
Didn't one of your students ask you why you weren't Jewish, like so many of the other teachers?
That made me think a lot, and it reminds me when you talk a few minutes ago about one of the teachers in your school, what a huge core of Irish Catholic women there was in the old days. But by the time I got into the school system. The World War II was over, and so many young Jewish men were going into teaching, and it was dominated. Yeah, at one time, the New York public school system was Irish, and even though there was also a Catholic school
when I was a kid, most of my teachers were Irish.
Yeah, yeah.
But you were Seward Park is an immigrant school, isn't it? A lot of kids don't even speak English.
It's the melting pot school. That's where I learned. That's where I had to understand the frustration of people who trying to learn a language, especially American New York teenagers, foreign teenagers, who wanted to be cool, baby, and hang out in the street and say the smart-ass things that New York students say. So I learned how to slow down, try to explain things clearly, and try to help them overcome their frustration. Because I didn't have linguistic frustration. I had other frustrations, but so I understood frustration in general.
But you also sometimes misjudged your students. You talk about assuming that some girls you were teaching wouldn't be interested in going to see Hamlet.
Yeah.
And it turned out they were very interested.
That's partly being interesting, partly wanting to get out of the classroom and go on a trip. I also took them to a movie on Times Square at the time, which was a riotous adventure. But they wanted to see Hamlet because all the other classes were going. And they thought, and they were right, I didn't have those expectations of them. We went to see Hamlet, and they were very animated when we came back, and they discussed it.
Frank McCourt is my guest. His latest book is Teacher Man, a memoir published by Scribner. This is WNYC, AM and FM, and online at WNYC.org. So the next thing you did was to go back to school, but you applied to go to Trinity College in Dublin to get a PhD, not an American school.
No.
Why?
Well, I think at that time in the marital department, I was floundering. I thought, and she thought, it might be a good idea if I just went away. Also, Trinity didn't have European universities assume that by the time you reach that level of doctoral candidacy, you've had some education. NYU also accepted me, but NYU would require me to pass two languages and to take courses. I think it's 30 credits or something, or 64, I forget which. And then to do the comprehensive examination, and then the examination defending my dissertation. And I didn't see myself going back to school. Whereas I went to Trinity, you write your dissertation, and they put you through a very rigorous grilling when you're defending your dissertation.
But it's also a school that you might not have gotten into it when you were younger because you were a Catholic.
No, you could get into it, but if you the minute you walked in the door, you were excommunicated by the Archbishop of Dublin. That was the Protestant stronghold.
Did you earn your PhD?
No, I didn't. I went there and I had a great time in Dublin. I did a lot of research, but not on what I should have been doing.
Like J.P. Donlevy?
Yeah, I wasted my time. I wasted a lot of time.
So you came back, and now you needed a job again. You could only get a job as a substitute teacher.
Yeah.
You say that at the school that you taught at, only the Chinese kids came to class.
Yeah, yeah.
So was this something that depressed you, you know, knowing that you were there ready to get to these kids and they didn't care?
No, I understood, and I think most people in the public schools understood the nature or the role of a substitute teacher. You come in, you're expected to teach, but the kids decide otherwise, and they disappear.
Now, this all doesn't sound very promising, but then you wind up getting a substitute job at Stuyvesant, and that changes your life.
Yeah, that was the beginning. That was the real beginning of my teaching career.
Was that considered at the time like winning the education jackpot?
Yeah. That would be like a kid getting into Harvard, in a way, and a scholarship. Because every teacher in the city was clamoring to get into Stuyvesant High School or Bronx Science.
But I would imagine also there's a problem when you have kids who sometimes know more than you know about certain things.
Well, they did.
So how do you teach kids who say, but Mr. McCourt, isn't it so
that's right. And you know, Lenny, the thing in a school like that or in any school, you have to tell the truth. You have to be honest. Because they catch you out, or they have these little detectors that reveal when you're telling when you're being a phony. So I had to drop the mask, the teacher mask, and be human and raise as you say the level of discourse and the level of teaching. I couldn't talk down to it. It's not that I was talking down to the foreign kids in Sewell Park. I was trying to make myself clear, and I had to cut out the baby talk at Stuyvesant.
But at Stuyvesant, you were teaching kids who generally driven by interest in math and science. You were teaching creative writing after a certain point. Were they interested in that too?
The talent was there, all kinds of talent. I used to have my kids enter various contests, especially the New York City High School Poetry Contest, and year after year they'd win. And then at that time when I started at Stuyvesant was when they admitted the girls. The 14 girls passed the... There was a class action suit, 14 girls passed, 9 came, and I was the homeroom teacher for the 9 Vestal Virgins.
You also were a very popular teacher by this point. Didn't one divorced mother offer to spend a week with you at a resort of your choice if you let her daughter into your creative writing class?
Yeah, this was
That's a tempting offer.
Oh, God, there were all kinds of tempting offers.
Were you divorced at this point?
Yeah, no. No, I think I was separated at that time, but I was in divorce.
So what happened?
Nothing. Nothing. I let her into the class did not take advantage of the kind offer.
How had you come to teach creative writing? You hadn't written any books by that time.
No, I don't know. I had written a few things in the Village Voice and Newsday and so on, and I suppose I was the only one in the department that had actually published something, so... the chairman, Roger Goodman, told me, well, why don't you teach? Because the former teacher didn't want to do it anymore, so I was pitched into it.
Well, there are some people who argue that you really can't teach people.
I argue that myself. I'd say you conduct a class, but I used to say to the kids, we're all in the same boat here. And they surprised me because usually writing teachers lay down the law, and I said, I don't know what, you find your own voice. Look at Mark Twain, or look at J.P. Dunleavy, or look at any of the stylists, and each one has it. And what I was doing then, Lenny, the most astonishing thing was I was learning myself. I was learning something about writing.
But you also were using rather unorthodox methods. Were any of the administrators concerned about that?
No, no. They would always poke their noses in the door or look in the window to see that everything was all right. And
the kids were engaged.
They were engaged, they weren't fighting, they weren't throwing things and so on, they weren't running down the hallway, as long as you kept them in your seats.
You seem to suggest that it was harder dealing with the parents than it was with
often,
the students.
Especially at Stuyvesant High School, where you have parents with high expectations and parents who are easily disappointed by the kids.
My son got a B.
Uh-oh. Is that bad? Where?
No, I mean, I'm just saying that's the sort of thing. Why'd you give him a B?
But after a while, they didn't bother me in the beginning. And the parents of Stuyvesant and a lot of schools are very active, but I suppose I was able to explain what I call my methods. One parent came in and said that I wasn't rigorous enough, that I should have hewed to the textbook and so on and made them spew it back. But that wasn't my style.
You have some harsh words for some of the divorced parents. You're a divorced person yourself.
Yeah. The kids, there was such a high rate of divorce among the student population, their parents, and they were tormented, a lot of them, because they were shuttled between parents, and they would. What I liked about the kids at Stuyvesant is how supportive they were of one another.
Well, you also tell the story of a boy named Ken who disappointed his parents by refusing to apply to Harvard or MIT.
Yeah, that's right.
But what about when you got creative writing that suggested real problems? There was a girl who once wrote something about being abused in response to a school assignment. How do you respond to that?
You turn it off to a guidance counselor. You can't do anything yourself. You can't. You don't have the time, first of all. And then if you get involved, you can't get involved with 170 kids, 175, with their particular problem. Because in the beginning, they'd say, "Oh, Mr. McCaw, when is your lunch hour, and could we meet and have a cup of coffee?" And in the beginning, you say yes because you're very flattered that they're looking on you as a father figure or a counselor, and you do it. And then you realize at the end of the day, you're exhausted. And what was that all about?
You've said that many of your Stuyvesant students were uncomfortable with the open-endedness of your assignments. Did they want you to just give them yes and no kinds of questions?
Yeah, they wanted summaries and answers. And I describe how Ed Marcantonio was teaching math across the hall, would lead them through a problem. And he was brilliant. He was so graceful and elegant and everything else, and a very appealing man. And he would lead them through, and at the end of the warning bell would ring. And they knew the answer was coming between the warning bell and the end of the period. And there was a kind of feeling, orgasmic feeling over mathematics.
What answers could you give in creative writing or in English?
If we were talking about it, we used to discuss Shakespeare a lot. If we were talking about Hamlet, and that was the big one. So the question at the beginning of the period was, why was Hamlet mean to his mother? And we discussed this, going back and forth, the warning bell would ring, and you felt a stiffening in the class, an expectation. Then they know the bell is going to ring. So why? I said, what do you think?
They wanted the catharsis.
They wanted. They'd wander into the hallways, moaning and griping and cursing me.
Well, you were still a very popular teacher, so it couldn't have been that bad. Have you been following the current situation in New York's public schools?
I think
that Mayor Bloomberg's reforms?
Give me a soapbox, Lenny.
You have 1 minute.
They've extracted another 10 minutes from the teachers daily. A few years ago, they extracted 20 minutes, so that's a half an hour. ATTO, all that time off. They never give the teachers any credit for what they do at home.
If you were named school's chancellor, what would you do?
Well, I'd certainly go to Albany and get more money for the teacher salaries, and I'd cut the school day, and I'd certainly cut the size of the classes because they're monstrous. And I'd have a parliament of teachers, classroom teachers. I'd have no administrators, supervisors, and especially politicians.
You got the wrong idea. When you take the job as school's chancellor, you insist on having a private house and somebody who drives you to the office every day. Don't you know that?
Well, I think Joe Klein, they bought the chancellor's house in Brooklyn, which the previous chancellors refused to live in. I don't know where Joe Klein lives.
Meanwhile, Frank McCourt lives out of town these days, but he's written a wonderful book about his experiences teaching in the city, Teacher Man. It is published by, what did I say?
Scribner.
Scribner. Thank you so much for being with us. Thanks for listening to today's podcast of the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.